says Israel must join the Chemical Weapons Convention without delay or any preconditions. Israeli tanks fire at a Syrian village in Qunaitra. No report on possible casualties. Also ahead, Venezuela says the opposition must recognize its mistakes if it wants to restart talks with the government. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran says the United States and Israel are obstructing the complete elimination of chemical weapons in the world. Addressing a UN Security Council session, Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN expressed deep concern about the US non-compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention. Zahra Irshadi stressed that the US is the only member state of the convention which still possesses chemical weapons. She added that Israel must be forced to join the arms control treaty immediately and without any preconditions. The convention bans the use, production and stockpiling of chemical weapons. The Iranian envoy further highlighted a serious commitment to destroy its chemical stockpile. She said the UN Security Council's monthly sessions over Syria have no justification when the convention's implementing body has approved the elimination of Syrian weapons. And Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks describes as positive the ongoing negotiations between Tehran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal. Ali Bagheri-Kani says the participants are working to get the ultimate results. He says an agreement to effectively remove anti-Iran sanctions can guarantee the success of the talks. He noted that an agreement could be reached faster if the other sides are ready to accept Iran's proposed mechanism for the verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the US will not abandon the deal again. Iran and the remaining signatories, namely Russia, China, Britain, France and Germany, are engaged in their eighth round of talks in the Austrian capital. The US unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and is not directly involved in the talks. We've reached out to political analyst Said Mohammed Mirandi for his take on the latest round of Vienna talks. He says the only thing that needs to be done at this stage to achieve a success is for the United States to return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal.
During the current negotiations, as we speak, it's the United States that has left the table. The United States left the nuclear deal. The Iranians are saying if the United States wants to re-engage, if they wanted the P5 plus 1, which became the P4 plus 1, to become the P5 plus 1 again, then they have to implement the deal. It's not very complicated. The Americans and the Europeans are dragging their feet, but it's quite simple. This has already been negotiated 6 years ago. With regards to the JCPOA, the Iranians negotiated extensively with the United States to reach the deal. And what happened immediately after the deal? Obama began violating the deal behind the scenes. He told the Treasury to threaten banks not to cooperate with Iran in violation of the deal, and then Trump tore up the deal. So every time Iran engaged with the United States, it was stabbed in the back. The Iranian position is clear. The Iranians expect a full implementation of the JCPOA. They expect a strong mechanism for verification. Because last time around in 2015, that was one of the major flaws of the nuclear deal. The Iranian side, Iranian commitments were all quickly verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency, but there was no verification mechanism for the Americans and the Europeans, and they took advantage of that. As I said earlier, the Americans violated the deal from day one by imposing new sanctions, but also by dragging their feet with regards to implementation. This time around, the Iranians are saying the verification process and assurances have to be clear.
The Israeli military has attacked some positions in Syria's southwestern province of Qunaitra. Syrian media are reporting that explosions have been heard as a result of Israel's aggression in the Qunaitra area. They say Israeli tanks fired at a border village as choppers and surveillance aircraft flew over the area. There are no immediate words on possible casualties or damage. The Israeli army has confirmed the attack in a statement, claiming that it opened fire to, quote, chase away suspicious individuals who then fled into Syrian territory. Israel frequently launches strikes on Syria. Damascus says the attacks are flagrant violations of its sovereignty and has filed complaints with the United Nations. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist. We have asked him for his take on the latest Israeli attack on Syria. This is what he has to say.
This is more criminal activity by the Israeli regime. As the Syrian spokesman said, these are flagrant violations of Syrian sovereignty. They are international laws, violations of international laws. They need to be dealt with. The United Nations has again and continued to shirk its duty by not acting. The fact that Israel is bombing Syria with impunity is criminal. There's no other way of looking at it. Major violation of international law, it must be stopped. An international militia with complete disregard for not only international law, but basic common human decency. The violations of human rights that Israel commits on a daily basis, they're simply shocking. The fact that Israel has illegally annexed the Golan Heights, again, this is not recognized by international law, and it shouldn't be, because it's a crime.
Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is suspending his hunger strike after 140 days following an agreement by Israel to release him. His hunger strike, which is one of the longest ever, brings to the fore the years-long challenges of many Palestinians that are held captive in Israeli jails for undisclosed allegations.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had a especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
The U.S. Attorney General has vowed to hold accountable anyone involved in last year's attack on the Capitol building by supporters of former President Donald Trump. The stern warning by Merrick Garland comes a day before the first anniversary of the violence. The Justice Department, headed by Garland, has charged more than 720 people with various crimes, including assault on police to conspiracy. Of those people, about 165 have pleaded guilty, and at least 70 have been sentenced to various jail terms. A large mob of Trump's fans stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. In a failed bid to derail the formal congressional certification of his 2020 election loss to President Joe Biden. Elsewhere, the president of Venezuela's National Assembly says the opposition must recognize its mistakes if it wants to restart talks with the government. Jorge Rodriguez also says negotiations can begin once the opposition returns the control of foreign assets, including a U.S.-based oil refiner, to the government. The comments come hours after opposition leader Juan Guaido called for the resumption of talks. Those negotiations, aimed at resolving the country's political crisis, were suspended in October. Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after Guaido dismissed the 2018 elections and declared himself interim president. Washington ramped up sanctions against the government of President Nicolas Maduro and imposed a freeze on all its assets inside the U.S. At least 8 security officers are killed and more than 300 others injured in Kazakhstan during widespread demonstrations over a gas price hike. A state of emergency is now in place across the country. President Kasym Jomart Tokayev has vowed to crack down on protesters whom he calls terrorists. There are reports of fires at the presidential palace. Other reports suggest the protesters have taken control of the capital's airport. Peacekeepers from a Russian-led alliance of ex-Soviet states are expected to arrive in Kazakhstan to help stabilize the country. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says the deployment is a response to Tokayev's repeal and the consideration of a threat to national security caused by outside interference. The European Union and the United Nations have urged the restraint following the unrest. And political commentator Tony Gosling says the unrest in Kazakhstan is apparently being orchestrated from abroad.
There's two competing narratives here, and I think I'll leave it to your listeners to decide which is the truest, really. One is that the outside powers very much want to get their hands on this incredibly resource-rich country. Well, oil is just one of the resources, gold and rare minerals. Now, we all know how much these new electric car-powered industries and solar industries are desperate for the sorts of minerals that are in Kazakhstan. So it could be that this is something which has been orchestrated from outside. Now, I would set you in. You might say, well, you know, that this is the sort of thing that is unlikely to be because it's a spontaneous thing from the people of Kazakhstan, and it may well be, particularly since the government has been upping all these energy prices. This, of course, is going to upset people, and it's one of the reasons that governments should not allow this sort of thing to happen, because what they're doing is they're providing an excuse for people to come out on the streets. But if you look at over the years about how revolutions have happened in countries, how governments have been overthrown and overturned, well, we can go back to Russia between 1917 and 1923, and China between 1946 and 49. These were very long, drawn-out, slow processes.
Turning to other news, the former British Defence Secretary reveals shocking details of a classified report on the 2003 war on Iraq. Jeff Hoon says he was ordered by Downing Street to burn a memo that suggested the invasion could be illegal. Hoon says former Prime Minister Tony Blair's chief of staff had asked to get rid of the document. Blair previously rejected as nonsense the claim, which first emerged in 2015, but Hoon, who has given an account of the cover-up, insists the allegations against Blair are true. It has thrown new fuel onto the fire. of outrage at Blair's recent knighthood. Over 600,000 people have signed a petition to rescind the honour the Queen has bestowed on him.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons. In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague, and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizup, London.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The U.S. National Conference of State Legislatures estimates that 700,000 of the nation's 4.2 million homeless youth are unaccompanied by a parent or guardian. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Eleanor J. Bader Ryder. This article is published under the heading 700,000 U.S. teens navigate school without family support or permanent housing. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. National Conference of State Legislatures estimates that 700,000 of the nation's 4.2 million homeless youth are unaccompanied by a parent or guardian. 1 in 10 young adults between 18 and 25 and 1 in 30 aged 13 to 17. What's more, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, more than half of unaccompanied homeless youth are under 18 and sleep outside, in a car, or in another place not meant for human habitation. Sonia Pizzi, coordinator of Education for Children and Youth Experiencing Homelessness in 8 Pennsylvania counties, works to keep homeless children and teens in school, whether they are living with their families in a shelter or motel or are on their own. She has done this work since 1995. This year, she reports that she is assisting 17 unaccompanied minors. 4 youths are living in storage units and 5 in an abandoned building that has water but no heat. The other 8 are couch surfing but have temporary places to sleep every night of the week, she told Truth Out. One of the unaccompanied kids who works with Pitsy spoke to 9 of his peers and then wrote a 3-page account of their routines and living conditions. Want to know what it's like? Wake up after sleeping on the floor. To get ready for your day. Oh yeah, you don't have electricity. Bathroom you can use? Gas station down the road. Showers? School or a gym that has allowed us access. Food, he continues, is cold if not eaten at school. But the biggest indignity? Group members have to carry their possessions everywhere they go, just in case, no matter where we stay every night. Sonia Pizzi has been able to get us Epic Packs, a brand name backpack, and compression sleeping bags so we can literally carry everything on our backs, he wrote. The stress is enormous, but Pizzi knows that keeping the kids connected to each other and to routines is essential. School is key. Schoolhouse Connection, a national Washington, D.C.-based group, works to keep homeless youth enrolled since numerous research studies have documented that one of the greatest risk factors for adult homelessness is not having a high school diploma or GED. Nonetheless, the group's executive director, Barbara Duffield, recognizes that staying enrolled is challenging since emotional and physical trauma is ubiquitous for this population. Pizzi explains that kids often become homeless due to parents' death, incarceration, or deportation. In addition, she says, some left home or were kicked out because of their orientation or gender identity. Some left because a parent chose their partner over them. Some had been abused, and some left because of heavy drug or alcohol use by the adults in the household. It amazes reporters how resilient these kids are, she says, but I do get a lot of crisis calls. These calls, she explains, happen when feelings of abandonment or being overwrought bubble up. The kids hear their peers complaining about the curfew or having to clean their rooms, and their grief builds. Why did my mom or dad choose something or someone over me? They wonder. Most of the time, they do great and Trajan, but every so often they get into a funk. Some need hospitalization, meds, or regular sessions with a therapist. Carol Hornbeck, a Minneapolis, Minnesota-based family therapist, told reporters that when a person experiences trauma, they typically either shut down so they do not remember what happened or they get stuck in memories that intrude and interrupt their peace of mind. It is not uncommon for people to experience a combination of both. Trauma, she says, can impair cognitive and emotional functioning. It can also impact a person's ability to make future plans. Survivors may also be prone to physical health problems and can be so disconnected from their bodies that they wait until they are in crisis to seek medical attention, Hornbeck says. Lastly, most find it hard to make new attachments and sabotage new relationships by constantly testing their acquaintances. An adult who cares can help, she says, but if the pattern is broken relationships, it takes hard work to achieve relationship stability. That said, Hornbeck adds that concrete material supports, housing, food, medical care, job opportunities, and tools for educational completion are essential to healing, but obstacles abound. Criminalization, for one, can derail degree completion and psychological stability. Nonetheless, teens are particularly vulnerable to being picked up by police or status offenses, arrest for things only considered a crime if done by a minor, such as curfew violations, school truancy, or running away from home. A November 21 report by the U.S. National Homelessness Law Center concludes that girls, youth of color, are disproportionately subjected to harsher penalties for status offenses that were ostensibly designed to protect them from victimization, but which instead lead to a criminal record that can impede future efforts to secure housing, school loans, or employment. Eric Tars, legal director of the Law Center, told reporters that a minor who leaves home without intending to return can be deemed by law enforcement as a person in need of supervision and sent to juvenile court. Likewise, with a minor who seeks shelter outdoors. These provisions give law enforcement reasons to engage with homeless youth, Tars explains. They do not help or protect young people. They treat them as a problem to be remedied. Such policies, he adds, can unwittingly push kids to avoid systems that might help them, including public schools, where they can get meals, shower, do laundry, and get on-site counseling. But even school attendance can be fraught, since policy roadblocks can make access to school activities far harder than they should be. For example, many school programs require the sign-off of a parent or guardian in order for students to participate, something that is impossible for unaccompanied youth. A great starting point would be letting young people sign for themselves or coming up with other ways for kids to participate in programs or get services, Schoolhouse Connections Duffield says. She also makes clear that McKinney ventilations are also an unhoused student best linked to services and stresses that they are an essential component for staying on track. Furthermore, while school personnel are mandated reporters of child endangerment, Duffield notes that being an unaccompanied homeless youth is not a de facto reason to report.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Again, we are here to present with another episode of A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many important issues regarding Muslim lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studios, my wife Razia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm just thanking Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala to having this great opportunity. It's a biggest way of worshipping Allah. Thank you so much.
And what is the topic for today's discussion?
Yeah, I love it so much because I remember it, the way Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, he would talk about the role of women in politics, and he would connect it always with Lady Fatima Zahra salamullahi alayha. And do you know his birthday is the same anniversary of Lady Fatima.
And
he was from his generation, his Sayyid. So he had that connection with his mother, Lady Fatima Zahra salamullahi alayha. And truly, absolutely, you know, from my wholeheartedly, I'm telling this, I'm witnessing Allah, that the way he would put her as a role model for him and for us, that is, we have to appreciate, because he knows and we all know that how much our Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, she was active, yeah, in society, in politics. Not only she was in politics, she was the one who was running, you know, everything comes out from her, you know. She and Imam Ali, they were just capable to each other. They were in the same level of wisdom and knowledge.
Yeah, Imam Khomeini, definitely he was the initiator, somehow we can say that he is the founder of the modern Islamic world, we can say. As you know, he has provided so many freedom, even in the social life, in our society, in the political life. Although when the king of Iran, he wanted to make a rule in his government that women should participate in the politics of that time, Imam Khomeini opposed it. People were, you know, shocked.
Really? Okay.
They said, why Imam Khomeini is opposing? Imam Khomeini is against this idea that women should participate in the politics. So Imam Khomeini said, you know, this is the king of Iran. He is a secular king.
Exactly.
And he wants to misuse of, you know, the Muslim ladies and Muslim females. That's why I know his intention is something totally different. He does not want to give the rights of, you know, political issues to women. He wants to just misuse the, you know, our Muslim ladies and females. That's why I oppose, because I understand his intention. But when revolution came, the same Imam Khomeini said that our ladies should come in the field of politics also. So now people understood that Imam Khomeini is not against
exactly.
the rights of our women. He is a pro of rights of our women.
Yeah, yeah. And I love this ayah, and I can see this, you know, because I know him, that the way he would always quote the ayat of the book of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. Quran says that wal mu'minun wal mu'minat ba'dhum awliya'u ba'd, yeah, like both. mu'min and mu'mina, female believer and male believers. They are, both of them are supporting each other. Allah has given some rights to educate or to help and support each other. What they do, what kind of rights they have, يأمرون بالمعروف, ينهون عن المنكر. You know, it's so amazing. And I could see these verses of Quran are the true tafsir, the true explanation and the true meaning of this ayat, practically Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi has done in his life, that women has their own role to play in the society, like engaging people towards goodness. You know, how you can engage and you can invite Amr bin Ma'aruf toward goodness by using your vote, for example, by giving your opinion about this ruler or about this, you know, whatever decisions they are making about the politics. So her role is, Imam Khomeini, when he was in Paris, people would come and ask him that you are going to establish a government, so what about women? He would say, not only women are the part of the society, they are the very sensitive and important part of the society, where they are playing a very crucial role. So don't ask about women, you know, about women to me.
This is something astonishing, you know.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the role of women in the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Ali. We can see that in Afghanistan, the so-called Taliban, they said they are the real Muslims. Yeah, they have the government in their hands and they are, you know, not taking care of female rights.
Absolutely.
Anymore. This is
the ignorant
era of our modern time. But look at Imam Khomeini. As soon as he brought the revolution in Islam, in Iran, the Islamic revolution, he opened the doors for all the members of society, male and female. Not only he opened the door, he said, I'm proud of my countries, my Muslim families, my, you know, ladies, females, because they have played a very vital role in our Islamic revolution. You know, they came to the roads and they came to protest against the cruel king. They were playing their role shoulder to shoulder with all the males of this country, all the gents of this country. So Imam Khomeini, not only he, you know, he was supporting female, but he was encouraging. He was saying that I'm proud. Being a marja, you know, not only a leader of a country, he is the leader of the whole Muslim Shia world.
Yeah,
you know,
because he's the expert and his opinion.
Definitely.
He was not an ordinary leader.
Yeah, he was not an ordinary president of a country. He was a marja, mujtahid, and all over the world, people would obey him.
Yeah.
You know, being a marja and saying I'm proud of all the Muslim, you know, female ladies who have played a very vital role in our society, this is something we have to write with golden water.
Yeah. And one more thing which I truly appreciate is the in Islamic education. Okay? Before we have touched a bit I have seen myself. I'm one of the fruits of beautiful the facilities which Imam Khomeini has provided after the revolution is definitely, you know, me, because I can see, I have observed myself that you can reach to the level of ijtihad. Can you believe it? Like before Imam Khomeini, it wasn't that much, the facilities were not open for everyone. As an observer, I can see that whenever you listen to his talks and you can see the way he's providing, the giving the rights in his government, that was like in one side is emphasizing a lot, as we have talked in our previous episode, that, you know, you mothers, your house, your family structure. And other side, he said, come, rush towards the society.
He says, be it active. Is your duty.
Yeah. Come. Play your role here, there, you know, everywhere during the war. This is very interesting, Mr. Masumi, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was the only Imam who had like for four
government,
government for like long period, more than 4 years. So during the Siffin War, because Siffin War took very long time, during the Siffin War, you can see that how Imam Ali is involving women, how much, you know, role he's giving to female of the society. The same way you can see about Imam Khomeini, because during the this war between Iran and Iraq, again you can see, you know, that how much women were active. So this amazing balance between inside the house and outside the house, and education and ijtihad, and, you know, everything. Nowadays we have, you know, millions of, or not more than thousands of specialist women in, so Islamically I'm talking, otherwise in classic education, mashallah, you know, that is out of our imagination, and we cannot count about them. So he has done no doubt wonders for women.
Like I said, you know, we had so many maraje before him also. No any marja has given this much importance to our female.
Yes.
Nobody said it is your duty to come in politics and to come in front of your society and play your role. All the maraje, they would say, you know, it is better for you to stay within the boundary of your house and play your role as a mother and wife and fulfill your duties like this. But Imam Khomeini said, although it is important to play your role in your family as a mother and as a wife and as a daughter, but it is again your duty to come forward in your society, come forward and play your role in politics.
Yeah,
which is,
you know,
totally
the way, Mr. Masumi, you are comparing Imam Khomeini to other mujtahid and expert and maraj. That is very, very important. Usually we don't do it.
Although other maraj also, they had their own ideas. They were great maraj, and we cannot say they were wrong. You know, but we are talking about the, you know, Imam Khomeini's intelligence, the vast mind of Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala, how much he had open mind.
MashaAllah, you know? MashaAllah. Thank you so much, and we enjoyed a lot. Alhamdulillah. Fi amanillah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
the Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Around 4 million homes in the United Kingdom were already classed as fuel poor before a surge in global energy market prices triggered one of the steepest ever energy bill hikes in October. But campaigners are braced for a record increase in the numbers unable to pay their energy bills following another price hike this spring. We have prepared for you an article written by Gillian Ambrose. The piece is titled, Charity Warns 6 Million UK Homes May Be Unable to Pay Energy Bills After Price Hike. According to a fuel poverty charity, the number of UK households living in fuel poverty could climb to the highest level on record by this spring, unless the government moves to soften the blow of a looming record high energy bill hike. Around 4 million homes in the United Kingdom were already classed as fuel poor before a surge in global energy market prices triggered one of the steepest ever energy bill hikes in October. But campaigners are braced for a record increase in the numbers unable to pay their energy bills following another price hike this spring. The charity National Energy Action warned that the double blow to household bills could cause at least 2 million more homes to slip into fuel poverty compared with the start of 2021, taking the total to 6 million households. This would be the highest level of fuel poverty across the United Kingdom since records began in 1996. The looming energy price hike has not yet been finalised by the regulator, but Adam Scorer, chief executive of National Energy Action, told The Observer that the number of households in fuel poverty would skyrocket in April. This is expected to deepen the UK's national energy crisis and compound the year of the squeeze, predicted by the Resolution Foundation recently, which threatens to trigger a cost-of-living catastrophe for hard-pressed families. Households are already paying record prices to put petrol in their cars and can expect the cost of consumer goods to rocket as fuel prices and supply chain disruptions take their toll on major companies. Adam Scorer, chief executive of National Energy Action, said, "Those on lowest incomes and in less efficient homes will not just face financial hardship, but intolerable living conditions, ill health, and for too many, a shortened life." He added, "This is not just a conjecture, it will happen, and we've had enough time to see it coming and act." Energy market prices climbed steadily over 2021 before leaping to record highs in October and fresh record highs in December. The market rally has fueled one of the steepest energy price hikes in the history of the United Kingdom's liberalized energy market. Ed Miliband, Shadow Secretary of State for Climate Change and Net Zero, said, "Working people are being hit by a cost of living crisis which has seen energy bills soar, food costs increase, and the weekly budget stretched. The government must take urgent action to support those people struggling to pay bills." Senior officials from the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, the Treasury, and No. 10 Downing Street have already met with industry regulator Ofgem and executives from the UK's biggest energy suppliers in recent weeks to thrash out a plan to avert the looming national energy crisis. No measures have so far been agreed, and further meetings are scheduled in the coming days. According to industry experts, the government's energy price cap could allow the average energy bill to rocket further to almost £2,000 a year when it is reset in April, from £1,138 in the previous year, to help cover the cost of dozens of failed energy suppliers. Ed Miliband, Shadow Secretary of State for Climate Change, said, "Labour has called for a value-added tax, VAT, on energy bills to be cut as a first step to help every household this winter, and the party would also ramp up ambition with our plan to retrofit 19 million homes to make them more energy efficient and help bring down household bills." Miliband added, "It is a moral and social scandal that fuel poverty exists in modern Britain, but with national leadership, we can beat it and ensure everyone has the warm, secure home that they deserve." A government spokesperson claimed protecting consumers was its top priority, which is why it was keeping in place the energy price cap, alongside schemes such as the £500 million Household Support Fund, the Warm Home Discount, winter fuel payments for over 65s, and cold weather payments. Meanwhile, several Conservative politicians have written to Prime Minister Boris Johnson urging him to scrap taxes on rapidly rising energy bills. About 20 Tory MPs and peers have written in the Sunday Telegraph asking for help for consumers facing fuel poverty, including Craig McKinlay, chair of the Net Zero Scrutiny Group of Conservative MPs, former Work and Pensions Secretary Esther McVeigh, and MPs Robert Halfen and Steve Baker. They argue that high energy prices are felt more painfully by the lowest paid, and suggest that value-added tax or VAT on energy bills and environmental levies which fund renewable energy schemes. Moreover, according to a report, almost 5 million families in social housing in England are facing the biggest rent hike for a decade from April amid a mounting cost of living squeeze. The Resolution Foundation think tank said 4.75 million families would see rent on their local authority or housing association home rise by up to 4.1%, adding to the pressure on living costs by an average of £202 extra a year. It warned the increase would coincide with significant tax rises planned by the government to come in from April, and a further jump in household utility bills when Ofgem's consumer energy price cap is raised. The Bank of England also forecasts inflation will peak at about 6% in the same month, April, the highest level since 1992. It added, rising social rents on top of these increases will be very damaging for living standards indeed. Social housing providers set rents each year within a cap calculated on the Consumer Price Index measure of inflation for September plus 1%. While this is a cap rather than a requirement, most providers are expected to raise rents by the full amount. It comes after the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, reached 3.1% in September. The latest rise follows a decade of housing costs rising faster than incomes for those living in social accommodation, with families renting from local authorities and other providers suffering a faster increase than those in private rented homes or those who own their property. According to the report, social renters now spend 19% of their income on housing costs after housing benefit is taken into consideration, up from 15% a decade ago, equivalent to an extra £768 per year for the average family. In contrast, the share of income for private renters has remained flat over the same period, at an elevated level of 31%. Housing costs for homeowners have fallen from about 10% to 9% thanks to a drop in interest rates over the past decade. Housing benefits paid by the government will help cushion the blow for some social renters, although the think tank warned the proportion of people receiving support from the state had dropped in recent years amid rising employment levels. Almost half of social renters do not receive housing benefit, meaning they will need to cover the biggest increase in social rent costs for a decade by themselves from the month of April. Lindsay Judge, Research Director at the Resolution Foundation, said the rise would put particular pressure on the 2 million social renters who don't receive housing benefit but who are likely to face falling real wages, rising taxes and soaring energy bills. Lindsay Judge added, while government support has purportedly helped to limit rent arrears from building up among social renters so far, raising rents to the maximum uprating would be unwise given the cost of living crunch hitting families hard recently.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.